Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 102.
It feels like so much more.
Okay, full disclosure, darling listeners. We bragged this week on Patreon that we have some wonderful new kit. We have beautiful new microphones, beautiful new inputs, all the fancy stuff that proper podcasters use. It has been a goddamn ordeal setting it up this evening. For some reason, all of the kit that we normally use and all of the recording systems, no. We don't recognize your voice.
Because we actually bought proper stuff that has settings and things rather than just plug it in and yell at stuff.
And I'm starting to see the beauty of those systems. What was wrong with the Blue Yeti, Mike, that we used for so long?
And we're convinced we were expert sound engineers. We could figure this stuff out.
Totally.
It's taken an hour and two red hooks to get somewhere vaguely recordable.
The words that of some critics out there that I am too loud and harsh, they hurt, okay? So I thought I'd invest in better mics. And now, actually, screw them. I don't care.
She's going to be louder.
It's very disconcerting when you can control the levels and you see on Audacity, oh, that's what it's supposed to sound like. Oh, okay. But yes, this has been a moment. But how are you, Nick?
Ah, delightful. We have a new kit. It's very exciting. It's all very shiny. And I feel very professional.
And also we've had two red hooks.
That definitely helps.
So this is going to turn into a drunk and insanity episode,
Most
I think.
Most likely, yeah.
That's
we're heading
pretty
that way quickly. That's what it's all about.
Any poisonings this week?
No.
No, absolutely not.
No, none.
You
none
shan't
whatsoever.
Be drawn on it at all.
No, it wasn't me, Gav, honest.
No poisonings, that's okay, that's very good. Okay, well, speaking of no poisonings and technology that drives you mad by strangling you in the night, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious Patreon subscribers.
We should indeed. Now, we have had no new Patreon subscribers this week, but that's fine. It's fine. But thank you very much to everyone out there who does subscribe. You are most lovely, and if you ever considered it, there is fantastically exciting stuff over on Patreon to get involved with.
You have all been amazing Patreon subscribers, but we also have some extra content on Patreon this week because we're building ever closer to the season 2 finale. Mm. And for that episode, we are planning a bit of a retrospective on all of the Poisoner's Cabinet episodes to date.
Yeah, I feel it should be some sort of big gallery. The Sinead and Nick retrospective.
Absolutely.
Poisoner's Cabinet retrospective. It sounds very fancy.
People walk around with just glasses of wine going,
we should hire like the White Cube or something. And
the White Cube?
Big gallery.
Oh, is it? Oh, I shows how cultured I am. I thought, like, get a big white cube, people will be impressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And clearly that was the premise of that gallery. Hey, yeah, see, art. I know art.
Art, yes.
Yes, for that episode, we are planning to look back on the last two seasons of The Poisoner's Cabinet. We're going to be sharing our thoughts on our favourite, weirdest, most dastardly and strange episodes that we've covered. But we would love your input. We are sharing messages and questions on social media where we're asking for your opinions, your highlights of the last two series. Patreons do get an extra bonus question. We will try to read out as many of the answers as we can, but also your answers may influence our decision, so it's always worth giving it a go.
I am very susceptible to all sorts of bribery and suggestions.
Are you ready?
No.
To drink cocktails and talk about poison.
Well, I think so. My red hook is gone.
We could drink poison and talk about cocktails.
No. More
poison cocktails. Being technology.
Technology, the greatest poison of them all. we haven't come across that one yet.
No, we haven't. We don't really do episodes in the future. The future. God, we're old.
I think we should.
The future is technology. It's like, no, it's very much the present and the past, for God's sake. It's us just drinking microphones going, I don't understand it. Or, should we branch out into futuristic poisonings?
Okay. Or just like, do episodes from Star Trek or something.
Again, so old.
What?
I don't know. I don't know modern sci-fi. Babylon 5. I don't know.
That's quite old.
That is quite old.
That's quite old.
The one with Rihanna in it.
The what now?
Yeah, she did a sci-fi, didn't she?
Did she?
Yeah, Rihanna. She did the big spaceshipy thing with Rihanna. That was the name of the film.
I mean, it sounds great. Coming to cinema soon, the big spaceshipy thing with Rihanna.
You would go and see that.
Absolutely.
Who would not go and see that? Apparently it was not well received.
Yeah, I can imagine with a title like that.
These are all ideas for season three. Well, it's Nick's episode this week. Hooray, hooray, hooray. But as we've established, we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, every week we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell and will flavour our cocktail of the week. Nick's story, so his pick. And Nick, the secret ingredient this week is...
It's a lovely horse.
A horse?
A horse. Or horses, potentially.
Horses.
Horses.
Horpodes. No, what? No. That's the Greek. No.
No, it's not.
Well, it is. Podes is Greek.
Yeah, but horpodes isn't...
No, it's not. No, absolutely
isn't the
not.
Plural for horses. No. That's something entirely different.
Horses. Lovely.
Yes,
who doesn't love a lovely horse? My lovely horse running through the field. A horse. We haven't had a horse on the show for a while, actually.
We haven't had the horse on the show. This is true.
No. Oh, Nick, how could you forget the best horse we've ever had on the show? Chicken.
Oh, yes. The horse. Yeah, yes.
Way back in episode 3, I think it was.
That was a while back.
Blazing in my memory. Chicken, the worst horse ever who ran a race. There's things you can do with a horse, cocktail related or non.
Okay,
you put a saddle on it.
No more cocktails for Sinead. This has gone horribly wrong already.
Okay, with horse as your inspiration and ingredient, is a horse going to get into a little class?
Yes, indeed. I've minced a horse.
Oh, come on. I was thinking a little pony. You minced it immediately.
No, we are having a horse-inspired drink rather than a horse-flavoured drink.
So what have you come up
with? So we're going to have a white horse.
A white horse?
A white horse.
Ooh, I like it.
I'm glad.
And very apt for the county in which we live.
This is very true.
Because our emblem is a white horse.
It is.
Right.
It is indeed. We are not in the county where we live, though. For the story. We are now. But not physically.
I'm not kidding, Nick. For a minute I went, we aren't? What has happened in the time we played with technology? We've gone back in time and changed county.
And yes, time and space.
Lovely. Great. This is going to go well, I feel.
Good Lord.
So I think before any of this madness continues, it is time for us to go into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm.
And make a coffee, I think.
Just descend into crying. Let's shake up a storm, so we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
So, Nick, we have, a white horse.
A white horse.
But it's not white, Nick.
It's not white, I know.
It's not white. It's
I
not...
thought it might be more white, but it's not white.
Well, looking at it, it's very brown and amber, which is always a good colour in this show.
This is true.
I was thinking creamy. I was thinking milky.
You were thinking wrong.
I think the person who named this was thinking wrong. Was having a breakdown, clearly.
Yeah.
It looks interesting.
Well, indeed, yeah. I thought it would be lighter, of a lighter hue than it is.
Mm. Now, the brownie, ambery drinks don't often steer us wrong.
This is very true.
Should we have a little... sample the aroma first?
Mm.
Ooh, okay.
That's intriguing.
That is intriguing. That's got some spicy flavour there.
Liking the smell of that.
Well, okay. Cheers. Merry Christmas. Let's dive in.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Ooh, that's very nice.
Oh, my. This horse.
Ooh. Well, that's very nice.
That is a lot more subtle than I thought it was
going
to be.
Yeah, I thought it was... from obviously no horse in it, I thought it was going to smack you around the face.
It stroked you.
It stroked me, gently.
With kid gloves.
Well, that's good.
That's really nice.
I like that. Well done. Well done, horse.
I don't think the horse invented it.
Oh my God,
was this invented by a horse?
It was invented by a horse, and of horses done damn well, I say.
Considering all of the odds being against it. I can't place what's in it, though. I'm going to have another sip.
Not have a hazard a guess at something.
I'm going to think whiskey-based. I'm going to think bourbon or whiskey-based.
You are entirely correct with a whiskey.
But normally the whiskey-based cocktails, lovely as they are, come at you like, whoa, really, really harsh at the front.
Absolutely.
It's got a loveliness to it.
It has got a loveliness to it. So, yeah, I mean, we've just had two Red Hooks, which are... They're very potent.
They're punchy.
You know you've had a bourbon. Or if you do it with a rye, you know you've had it. But this is incredibly subtle. This is a Scotch whiskey. It's a blended Scotch whiskey. So nothing overly peaty or anything like that. But for the purpose, it's very nice.
Yes.
We then also have some dry vermouth in there.
Oh, a dry vermouth.
Yeah, dry vermouth, which is not something I would have imagined to put with a whiskey, but it actually works very nicely. Then we also have some Benedictine.
Oh, bloody hell, you're just getting every ounce of use out of that Benedictine,
aren't you?
Well,
I bought a bottle for last week, so I thought I might as well use some. So a bit of a herbally twang going on in the background, yeah. And then a dash of bitters. So that's it.
Is that it?
So it's just got the four things: whiskey, vermouth, Benedictine, and a bit of bitters, stirred with some ice.
Bloody hell.
And it's incredibly good. It's really nice.
Really nice.
Yeah, I'm surprised how good this is, actually.
Yeah. Benedictine, we used it last week. I always associate Benedictine with one of those at the back of the parents' cupboard, the herbally sort of drink that was chic in the 80s, I guess. It's been around for decades.
It's been around for centuries. So, yeah, it does have that sort of a Jaeger, chartreusey, herbally, yes, monk-made type thing.
Because to drink on its own, it's like having a bottle of Jaeger. You have to either really be into it or you're not.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, the quantities are, Benedictine, are a lot less than the other ingredients in here. 1 1/4 of whiskey, 1 1/4 of vermouth, and then 1/2 of the Benedictine. Well, so it's a lot less. Balances out incredibly well with the other ingredients. Yeah.
That has really enlightened me to the benefits of Benedictine.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I'm not usually a whiskey drinker or a fan of the whiskey drinks. But that's really nice.
You're a bourbon fan.
I like a bourbon. I'm not usually a fan of a Scotch whiskey. I generally find them a bit too smoky for my taste.
That's the point of a blended whiskey. It's not going to be peaty. It's not going to have that smokiness, the beauty of some of the finest Scotches that are out there. A blended whiskey is still lovely. It's blended. Some people will go to it, and you know, don't be cruel about things like that, you know, because there are some great blended whiskeys out there.
But in a cocktail mixed with other things, it works brilliant.
Well, wonderful. With our white horse firmly in hand. We have it by the reins. We're sitting on top of it. Have you ever ridden a horse, Nick?
No, I haven't.
Never ridden a horse?
I've never ridden a horse.
Ooh, no. I have.
Well, you went to a private school, so you're fancy.
Oh, I did not do well at horse riding.
the very fact that you had horse riding lessons as a child. Rode to school on your horse from your castle in the countryside.
Definitely.
Yeah, while the
trampling
rest of us were down the mines.
I asked for horse riding lessons because I am a girl and I was a little girl and girls love ponies
and
at some point.
Pony.
And I took horse riding lessons and I was not good at them because I'd read too many romantic novels of galloping through fields with your hair billowing in the wind, and I went to some riding school that was all put on the stiff jackets. You're going to go to a gymkhana and you have to be really upright and prim and proper, and that wasn't my jam. And then a horse bit me and I had to leave.
Or did you buy the horse and you had to leave?
It bit me first.
I know how to make a good cocktail. I'm happy with that one.
Yeah, okay, we both have our ways out of situations, Nick. Someday they'll combine. Is it time for a story?
It certainly is time for a story.
I'll gallop back.
Right, so today.
Okay.
Today on the story.
Okay.
We are returning to Australia.
Yay!
Australia to tell the story of one of the most famous outlaws of all time. Ooh. In the history of the world ever. Now, to some people, he was a folk hero.
Oh,
who took a stand against British colonialism. To others, he is a cold-blooded murderer who has very undeservedly been given the title of the Robin Hood of Australia. This is the story of Ned Kelly.
Yay! Yay! Oh, I'm so glad you've done this. Who would I like to tell me the story of Ned Kelly? Nick, obviously.
But you know the name. You know name Ned Kelly. Everyone knows the name Ned Kelly. And I know we have listeners in Australia, so I don't know which side of the fence you fall on. But make your own opinion from what we're going to tell you.
Okay.
And I'm sure many people will know many more details than I'm going to give in this condensed version of events. Now, Edward, or Ned Kelly, is... What? Now, what is so funny already?
Just with the little air quote.
Yeah, the little air quotes, yeah.
Ned. Derisive. Edward was his name.
Edward. He was Edward. Ned Kelly was born in Beaveridge, Victoria. Sometime between the end of 1884... and the middle of 1885, at some point around there. Now, at the time, Australia was a British colony, and Edward's father, John Kelly, also known as Red, he had been an Irish criminal who had been transported to Australia in his 20s for the crime of stealing some pigs. Desperately, desperately heinous crime.
Yep.
Off you go to Australia for the pigs.
I mean, that's very much what an Irishman would do. That's good bacon.
Absolutely. So he was. So he's in Australia. He's served his time in Van Diemen's Land, now known as Tasmania.
Dodging cannibals.
dodging the many, many cannibals. But after he completed his sentence, he decided, like many others, to make a new life for himself in Australia rather than return home. Now, Red worked numerous odd jobs before starting work as a farm labourer for the Quinn family. The Quinns, were Irish immigrants who had settled in Melbourne, and there he met Ellen Quinn. And the two fell madly in love, and they were married in 1850.
Aww.
Now, it was around this time in the 1850s that Australia became gripped with gold fever. The gold rush was on.
Ooh, nice.
And many, many men tried their hand at prospecting to find their fortune. And John Kelly was among them. He was one of these men. And while he didn't exactly strike it rich, he earned enough for him and his new wife, Ellen, to buy a farm of their own in the upcoming town of Beaveridge. And there they had 8 children together, with Ned being the eldest son, named after John's favourite brother, Edward.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, very nice.
That's a lovely picture you're painting.
It's delightful. It's a lovely, lovely time. Now, according to family tradition, family legend, Ned came into the world at the height of the Eureka Rebellion. Which was a conflict between colonial authorities and prospectors in late 1854. Now, this saw prospectors challenge the authorities over the cost of mining licenses and the huge taxes they had to pay on the fines that they made. And it got very violent, confrontational. So quite fittingly, from a very young age, Ned developed a rebellious streak and a strong aversion to authority, especially the police. He had very, very dim views on the police. Now, the up-and-coming town of Beaveridge turned out to be not quite so up-and-coming as the family had hoped.
Yeah, you were building that up a lot, actually. Yeah. You kept saying, up-and-coming, up-and-coming.
I'm like, I said it once.
You said twice. I'm like, is there going to be a Starbucks or something like that?
No, I said it once.
And then you said it twice there.
And I said it again.
And then you went, oh, no.
And then, no. So the family had hoped that this would be on the route to the goldfields and everyone passed through. But it turned out that this particular route was on a particularly treacherous bit of road. So alternative routes were created that bypassed the town entirely. Mm. And the family farm quickly began losing money. And as a result of this, John took to the bottle. Oh, he began drinking. I don't know why we had to confirm what that meant. Everyone knows what went to the bottle was. Just to make sure you don't know, he had a drink, you know.
He liked a drink. He didn't just take to the bottle and took it as his wife.
Just take the bottle. He drank from the bottle as well.
He drank from the bottle as well?
Things got so bad that eventually they had to sell the farm and move to another town called Avenel during the 1860s. Mm. Even now, in the town of Avenel, Ned Kelly is still remembered as a hero, particularly for one specific incident when he was only 10 years old, when he saved the life of a younger boy who was drowning.
Aww.
And even to this day, he is regarded as a hero of the town for this one act of heroicism. Now, since first arriving in Australia, John Kelly had tried his utmost to stick to the straight and narrow. He'd been arrested and convicted of a crime. He thought, I'm going straight. All is going to be well. And he tried his best to avoid any more legal troubles, but temptation got the better of him in 1865. His family was struggling for food, and the only way out he saw was to turn to a life of crime.
Did the bottle tell him to do
it? The bottle told him to do it. One day a calf wandered onto his land, and even though it was branded as belonging to Philip Morgan, John killed and butchered the animal for meat. Now, he was caught and charged with cattle stealing and sentenced to 6 months hard labour. Which seems a lot for killing a cow.
Well,
a calf.
Harsh times.
Absolutely. And harsh times, most certainly.
That is your livelihood. That's your commodity that you're going to sell and trade or eat.
This is absolutely true. Absolutely true. So, yes, 6 months hard labour. Now, this hard labour plus the drinking took its toll on John's health, and he died in December 1866, leaving the 12-year-old Ned as the man of the family, the main breadwinner. After a few years, the Kelly family were forced to move yet again, this time to an uncultivated patch of farmland outside the town of Greta. Now, there, they actually reunited with a lot of relatives. Ellen's parents, along with brothers, sisters, and their own families, had all relocated to this area. So there's a bit of a hub for the Quinn clan. Wherever they went, the Quinns developed a bit of a reputation for perhaps not the most law-abiding citizens. They were often accused of cattle and horse stealing before being forced to move on to new pastures. Now,
that's a lot to do in the new place.
Yeah, yeah.
Wherever they move to, just like all these horses,
all the cows, they're all mine now. They're all mine now.
It's not something you can hide under a jumper.
This is true, unless you had a very large jumper. So they were soon discovered for their horse and cow thievery and were run out of town, and they were moved somewhere else and stole some more horses and cows.
Indeed.
Ned began spending a lot of time with his uncles, who undoubtedly influenced his developing behaviour. But the defining moment of his youth came in 1869, when the 14-year-old Ned met bushranger Harry Power.
Heard of Harry Power?
Now, real name, Henry Johnson, but Harry Power is much cooler.
It is much cooler. Harry Power. Henry Johnson. He just arrived in Australia and went, "I am Harry Power. Ooh, that man commands the room. He can go free."
We have covered bush rangers in the past. Essentially, the term originally started out as a description of escaped convicts who hid in the Australian wilderness, but later it came to refer to any criminal who hid in the bush. Many had committed robberies and even murders, but they still had their fair share of sympathisers amongst the town folk, yeah. And a few became regarded as folk heroes who stood up to authority and fought the oppressive colonial forces.
Well, yeah.
Now, Ned takes an instant liking to this way of life, and under Harry Power's guidance, he started stealing horses and cattle and committing robberies. Ned's first brush with the law occurred during this time. And now he's only 15 years old, and he is accused of assaulting and robbing a Chinese merchant.
Hmm.
Ned was arrested, but his sister and two family friends testify that it was the merchant who had started the fight all along. It wasn't Ned. And as the Chinese chap had no witnesses on his side, the police had no choice but to let Ned Kelly go.
Oh, okay.
That's what happened. he is later arrested again as an accomplice in several robberies committed by Harry Power, but none of the victims can positively identify him, so again, he is released without charge.
Mm.
Ned's association with Harry ends in June 1870, when Harry is caught and arrested. However, his influence on his young protege is strong, and Ned has already built quite the reputation of a bit of a local hoodlum, really. Newspaper called the Banala Ensign wrote an article about the pair, and this is a quote: "The effect of Power's example has already been to draw one young fellow into the open vortex of crime, and unless his career is speedily cut short, young Kelly will blossom into a declared enemy of society."
Oh, that journalist was having a good day.
a vortex of crime.
A vortex of crime.
Who would love that?
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
That sounds great.
People are reading that going, I want a piece of this.
Exactly. There aren't enough vortexes.
Yeah. There's only a vortex of depression where I am and poverty. Vortex of crime. That sounds more promising.
Yeah. And this is pretty
blossom,
much...
Blossom. Blossom. Yeah. Again, positive word.
Yeah, absolutely.
Positive reinforcement.
Well, blossom into a declared enemy.
Hey.
I mean, and this is pretty much exactly what happens. From this point on, Ned Kelly is firmly on the wrong side of the law. Just a few months after Power's arrest, Ned is taken into custody for assaulting a hawker named Jeremiah McCormick. This time he was found guilty and sentenced to 6 months hard labour, but he was released early. He only enjoys this freedom for a few weeks before being locked up once more for horse theft, though this time the charge is later downgraded from theft to feloniously receiving a horse.
What?
Which is... possibly the best name for a crime ever.
Feloniously
receiving a horse.
Feloniously, so as in felon.
As in fraudulently.
As in fraudulently receiving a horse.
So he
hasn't, how does that differ from
receiving
a horse?
Well, so I think he hasn't stolen the horse. But
he's lied.
He's lied. He's conned the horse out of from this man. He's not conned the horse. He's conned the horse owner.
The horse has been tempted away by promises of marriage and fine living.
And fine riches.
The finest shoes you shall have on your hooves, my horsey friend. Yes, the horse is like giving evidence in court, dabbing itself with a little handkerchief. Lies, he told me.
He told me.
Is this the horse
lies.
That is the influence for the cocktail?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Oh, is it?
The felonious horse.
Because it seems like there's a lot of horses. And
there's a lot of horses.
One.
Yeah.
Okay, let's pick the felonious horse.
I didn't specify which horse was the inspiration.
Let's imagine this is a white horse.
I would go with that one.
Went to court in a veil.
Now, Ned got 3 years in prison.
Good, good.
For his felonious receiving of a horse.
That poor horse needed justice.
When he was released, he went back to stealing livestock. This time accompanied by his younger brother, Dan Kelly, who had taken up the mantle while his older brother had been locked up. And they would eventually go on to form the Kelly Gang, whose other members included Steve Hart and John Byrne. Now, in 1878, an event occurs that irrevocably put Ned and his brother on the path of no return. And it has become known as the Fitzpatrick Incident. Now, we don't know exactly what happened.
But
well, there are two different versions of events. Mm. One from the Kelly family and one from Constable Alexander Fitzpatrick. And neither one is a particularly reliable source. And now, in Constable Fitzpatrick's version, he says that on the 15th of April, he went to the Kelly household to take Dan into custody. There was an arrest warrant out for him for horse theft. According to the constable, he arrives at the house where he finds Dan Kelly and his mother, Ellen, and two associates, William Williamson.
Oh, nice.
And Bill Skillion.
Those are made-up names, if ever. What's your name? William Williamson, Bill Skillingston. Goodbye.
Now, they are all in the middle of dinner, and the constable agreed to allow Dan to finish his meal before taking him in.
Why? What?
Well, he's a kindly, lovely constable.
How good was the food?
Apparently, it was a lovely stew.
What? That's just awkward.
Yeah,
all right, so let's finish a meal for 40 minutes.
He's sitting there waiting. Now, while he is waiting, Ned arrives home. And he takes exception to the constable's presence and draws his weapon and shoots Fitzpatrick in the arm. And then, while the officer is incapacitated with a bullet to the arm, Ellen, the mother, knocks him unconscious with a shovel.
This is Fitzpatrick's version of events.
He reports that later they let him go after digging the bullet out with a knife.
So they shoot him, hit him on the head with a shovel, and then go, oh, actually, we regret this.
Actually, we'll take the bullet out, off you go. Be gone with you. That's his version of events. Now, it's unsurprising, the Kelly version puts rather a different spin on things. And according to them, Fitzpatrick arrives at the house drunk. And without a warrant at all. When he realised that Ned wasn't home, he starts making threats against Dan and Ellen and then makes a pass at Ned's sister, Kate, who is also there. Now, it's at this point that Ned arrives home to witness this drunken, uninvited policeman making very unwanted advances to his sister. Mm. Violence ensues, and during the fracas, the constable is wounded. Now, the doctor who treats Fitzpatrick after this event, whichever event it was, could not establish conclusively that the injury was the result of a gunshot. Might have been, might not have been. We're not entirely sure. The doctor also notes that the constable smells quite strongly of alcohol.
Yes.
Although Fitzpatrick claims that he stopped after his release and his assault, he stops at the bar to steady his nerves. He needs a drink to steady his nerves before he goes on to the doctor.
Plausible as that might sound, it's a very convenient narrative, isn't it? Oh, the policeman. Oh, yes, I turned up and they attacked me.
No.
Oh, and they struck me on the head with a shovel and then just let me go. No, they didn't. I can well believe he rocked up going, I'm going to make an example.
I'm going to make a name for myself.
Sorry, if you're a lawman at that time, does not necessarily mean that you are a saint. No excuses to anyone else at that time, but...
But, perhaps unsurprisingly, the police accept Constable Fitzpatrick's version as the truth. And arrest warrants are issued. Now, Ned and Dan Kelly go on the run, while Ellen, the mother, Williamson and Skillion are all charged and convicted of being accessories to attempted murder.
Mm.
Now, this does not go down at all well with the public. There is an outcry at the trial, particularly at the sentencing of elderly Ellen Kelly to hard labour.
Mm.
She's an old woman and she's been sentenced to hard labour, and people are not at all happy about this. And even behind closed doors, the Victoria Police are not happy about this situation. The commissioner calls Fitzpatrick's actions as generally bad and discreditable to the force.
Generally bad. Well, good.
So, yeah, well, indeed. But, I mean, this is done in private after the trial, where an old woman has been sentenced to hard labour. and he's going in the office. Probably didn't happen like that.
Yeah. Knowing nothing that succeeds this point of the story, I'm like, he's a hero. Why did the man come and attack him? But yeah, it's fucking police are going to back themselves.
You mean, and that is the feeling that many, many people in the surrounding area had. There was a huge amount of ill will generated by this trial and huge sympathy for the Kelly brothers. And while they are laying low, hiding, this is when they are joined by Joe Byrne and Steve Hart. And the gang hopes to raise money to appeal for Ellen Kelly's release.
Mm.
Now, with a lot of locals now on side, they tend to get advance warning of police activity, things like that. If they're hunting, they get to hear about these things. They get advance warning in late October when police have discovered their whereabouts, discover their location. The police dispatch an armed party to the location to take them down, to take down the gang. This group consists of four men, Sergeant Kennedy and Constables Lonergan, McIntyre and Scanlon. On October the 25th, 1878, they arrive at the camp at Stringybark Creek. Australia has some wonderful place names.
Oh my God, they have the best place names ever. Stringybark Creek.
Stringybark Creek.
That was just a series of words mashed together.
Yeah, but great words.
Someone turned up and went, I don't care, Stringybark Creek. I have a lot of places to name today.
The men who arrive, these police constables who arrive, none of them are experienced bushmen like Ned. And Ned, knowing that the police were out there, finds their horse tracks and follows them to their camp, where Kelly and his gang take them by surprise. When the gang enter the camp, only Lonergan and McIntyre are there. McIntyre is quickly disarmed and he surrenders. He's not willing to put up a fight. Lonergan, however, tries to run and Ned chases him down and shoots him dead. Now, allegedly, there was existing bad blood between Kelly and Lonergan. We don't know the history of what that was, but it looks like Ned takes this opportunity to settle a score. When Scanlon and Kennedy eventually return to the camp, the two other police constables, they found McIntyre sitting on a log and the Kelly gang waiting in ambush. Now, in the ensuing shootout, Scanlon is shot dead and Kennedy is mortally wounded, managing to crawl a few hundred feet before dying. During the chaos, McIntyre manages to jump on a horse. He reaches the nearest town and tells everyone that the Kelly gang have just murdered three police officers.
Ooh.
Now, from that point on, the Kelly gang are officially declared outlaws by the governor of Victoria. And under the recently passed Felons Apprehension Act, they are stripped of any rights and they can be shot on sight. Even if they are captured alive, doesn't matter. They're outlaws.
So is the punishment or the order that's placed on their heads, is that typical for an outlaw of the time?
For an outlaw of the time, absolutely.
Is it just no holds barred?
No holds barred, yep. If they are given this status of outlaw, they are beyond the law, in effect.
Wow.
Then, yeah, that it is, it's shoot to kill.
Shoot on
sight.
Do they have a bounty on their head?
Well, there may well be a reward. There is a reward involved in the Kelly case, and that gets increased as their activities go on.
Oh.
But yeah, the governor may well issue a reward, but it is, yeah, it's shoot on sight. The gang are active for around 2 years. They spend a lot of this time hiding in the Australian bush, really, relying on friendly locals to provide them with food and lodging,
mm-hmm.
and occasionally raiding a police station or something to get a bit of cash. Now, the police know that many of the townspeople are aiding the gang. And since they are having no luck capturing the gang, they decide to crack down hard on their sympathisers. Fortunately for the authorities, the Felons Apprehension Act also allows them to punish those who offer any aid to outlaws, any aid, shelter or sustenance. And so they are pretty much free to imprison anyone they have the slightest suspicion on being on the side of the Kelly gang.
Does ring bells.
It does. Yeah, you know what? It really does.
With certain things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, in one particularly brutal crackdown in January 1879, a Captain Standish rounds up 23 men who he believes are either friends or sympathisers, or their sister's wife's tennis partner's friend had a chat with them. Anyone who may have the slightest connection. And he imprisons them for months without any sort of charge.
Wow.
Now, this flagrant abuse of power has quite the opposite of its intended effect and only highlights the unfairness of the system against the poor, against the townspeople, and it encourages support of the man who was supposedly fighting this injustice.
I'm sort of wanting to stand up from my seat right now and cutting. I know it's complex, but the whole kind of kibosh on anyone black and white thinking.
That's not comfortable. It's certainly not a black and white thing. It's a very nuanced range.
Absolutely.
Now, say, Ned helps enhance his own reputation by writing his manifesto. It became known as the Jailrillery letter. It is a 56-page, 8,300-word declaration where he decries the abuses of the police, who he describes as, quote, a parcel of big, ugly, fat-necked, wombat-headed, big-bellied, magpie-legged, narrow-hipped, splay-footed sons of Irish bailiffs and English landlords. All said in a very good Australian accent.
Yes, in a good Australian accent. I will object to the Irish bit.
Irish bailiffs, English landlords. Sorry, you're rude. Just as bad as us on this one.
Yes, that's a lot of entire tribe rolled out.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very good.
It's very good.
It's not exactly eloquent, I'm going to say. I'm not going to object to it. I'm not saying you don't have to be.
I got the point across, I feel.
He got the point across.
Now, so in this letter, Kelly argues that he was forced to becoming an outlaw by circumstance outside of his control. He still blames Constable Fitzpatrick as the one who really started this all, and he calls for justice, not only for him, but for all the poor families of Australia who are subjugated under the tyranny of the English. During their time on the run, the Kelly gang did have a few moments where they behaved more like traditional outlaws, as you would expect outlaws to behave. Now, after the shootout at Stringy Bark Creek, the gang needed money urgently to go into hiding. And what is the best way to get money? Rob a bank.
Yay!
And that's the best way to get money.
It is. So few people
way.
Do that these days.
Yeah, absolutely. They chose the town of Aurora, and on the 9th of December 1878 they set their plan into action. First they hold up the nearby train station at Faithful Creek, where they take a bunch of hostages and they hold them in a brick outbuilding.
That's a lot, Nick. Hold up a bunch of hostages.
It's a whole plan. It's a whole big old plan.
This is just one part of it.
This is one part of the plan.
That seems like a lot, though.
Yeah. They hold up the train station.
Stressful. It's
they hold
stressful
up the train
for the
station.
Hostage.
Not the train, a train station.
They get off and like, here's your ticket, we're gonna kill you.
Pretty much, yeah. Something like that.
Into this box.
Now, the hostages include a travelling merchant who seems to be quite sympathetic to the cause, as he actually suggests that the gang takes new clothes, so they wouldn't look quite as out of place when they walk into Aurora.
Okay, 100%. Aren't we all picturing the travelling merchant as some flamboyant
oh, desperately
man
flamboyant.
With a trolley, and he's covered in the most finest of silks and the biggest of hats? Take of my costume trolley, my boy.
It's very, very, very good. Now, the day after they've taken the train station, they cut the telegraph lines, cutting off Aurora from the rest of the world entirely.
Ooh, nice.
Now, Ned, Dan and Steve Hart make their way to Aurora National Bank and completely clean it out, taking the bank manager, Robert Scott, and his family as further hostages so they cannot raise the alarm.
Ooh.
Now, back at Faithful Creek, the gang now have 37 hostages. Some reports say that the gang performed some trick riding to entertain the hostages.
What? Why? No.
Well, they're going up and down the street.
If you're
going
to be taken hostage, I'm sorry that you've been in this predicament.
But
we're going to give you a show.
We're going to give you a show.
I mean,
absolutely.
That sounds amazing. I'd do that. Yeah. Oh, no, take me hostage. Let me see some horseplay and maybe have some whiskey.
Now, I mean, and Robert Scott, the bank manager, he is so surprised by the courteousness of the gang that they all drink whiskey together. They're in there, they're knocking back some whiskey, they're having a grand time.
Yay!
Now, I do suspect that maybe these things have been added in later to enhance the sort of the folk appeal of Ned Kelly, but maybe not. The gang leave at 8:30 that evening, warning their captives to remain where they are for 3 hours or there will be trouble.
Stay where you are. We've no way of knowing if you've moved. But there'll be trouble.
But there'll be consequences if you do.
There'll be consequences 6 weeks from now.
Now, following the raid, several newspapers commented on the efficiency of its execution and compared this with the inefficiency of the police who have failed to capture the gang in weeks since the Stringy Bark police killings. Several hostages state that the gang have behaved politely and without violence during the raid. However, others also state that on several occasions, Ned and the gang become enraged and cock their revolvers and point them at hostages, threatening to shoot them. So there's two very differing sort of versions of how the thing went.
Pointing your gun is not the same as killing someone or hurting
absolutely.
Them.
There were certainly no deaths involved. There was certainly no shooting or anything
but
like that.
You can't walk around being lovely and handing out cakes and buns to everyone and doing like entertainment. People will kick off. Hostages will probably kick off.
Yeah. You can't take hostages without a threat of violence. Mm. So that's fair enough. A second bank robbery occurs a few months later in February 1879 in Gelridery. The plan is similar, although this one is slightly more ambitious. The night before, the gang descend upon the local police barracks and they take the only two policemen inside as hostages.
Good plan.
The next day, they dress up in police uniforms and manage to rob the bank with no violence whatsoever. They walk in as police and clean the place out.
Did no one ask the police why they're taking all their money?
Apparently not. They also take their horses to the local blacksmith to get reshoed and put the work on the police tab.
That's brilliant.
Which is brilliant.
I mean, how stupid is everyone in this town, by the way? How trusting of authority is
everyone? Well, you would be at that point. Now, I mean, it's during this robbery that Kelly leaves behind his famous Gelridery letter. Although it won't be published in full until the 1930s, it is here where he leaves his manifesto for everyone, for the public. Now, following these two robberies, authorities step up their efforts to hunt down the Kelly gang, and with contributions from the bank, they increase the reward for their capture to £2,000 per gang member. Today's money, it's about 1.1 million US combined for the four members. They also bring in a police unit from Queensland, which contains Aboriginal troopers. Now, they are much, much, much more skilled at tracking people through the bush.
Shocking.
Than the Victoria police. Eventually, this crack team from Queensland are able to track down the gang, but their efforts are hampered at every turn by the Victoria police, who really don't want to be upstaged by these Queenslanders.
Oh, God!
The Victoria authorities are already deeply unpopular with people who think they are corrupt and entirely incompetent for not being able to capture the gang in the first place. The last thing they need was to be upstaged by these Queenslanders and who to do their job for them.
Which is literally what has happened.
In the end, it is the reward money that gives them the advantage. The Kelly gang may well have been popular with many, many people, but the prospect of a huge pile of cash, it is inevitable that someone is ultimately going to choose the reward over friendship or loyalty.
A lot of money.
It's a huge amount of money. It's a huge amount of money. It's a family out of poverty, set for life. It's a difficult decision to make. So, and the person who makes that decision is Aaron Sherritt. Now, he was a friend of the gang who becomes an informant for the police. Now, some people believe that he is actually trying to be a double agent. And at one point, even the authorities suspect this, but they find a way to make him useful anyway. The police spread word around that Aaron is working for them, and they hope to draw the Kelly gang out of hiding, using Aaron more as bait than as an informant, really. Okay. The gang feel horrendously betrayed by Sherritt. They are obviously completely unaware of his maybe plan to be a double agent. Yeah. And they want him dead. Yeah. They feel entirely betrayed. On June the 6th, 1880, Joe Byrne and Dan Kelly travel to Woolshed Creek, where Sherritt lives. Now, when they arrive, they find four police officers inside Sherritt's home, only confirming even more that he had, in fact, turned traitor. The gang needed a way of separating their target from the group. They cannot take on four police as well. So to this end, they kidnap one of his neighbours and bring him to the front door of Sherritt's house. While they hide out of sight, they make him call out for Sherritt, who recognises his neighbour's voice and answers the door without hesitation. Joe Byrne pops out of the shadows and shoots Aaron Sherritt through the head.
Okay.
Now, the gang know that the police inside Sherritt's house are instantly alerted to this attack, and they are going to send word of what has happened to Melbourne, to the authorities in Melbourne, who in turn will send reinforcements by train down to the area. Now, that train will pass through the city of Benalla, where undoubtedly more officers will join the train, and then eventually to the town of Glen Rowan.
You are making this kind of picture of a train that is just jam-packed full of police.
It is
some sort of clown car effect of just...
It is a special train that the Melbourne police put on, it purely to transport the police down there to get there. This is not just a passenger train that the police are on. they put on a special train to get the officers down there. They realise that the sort of staging post for this is going to be the town of Glenrowan. And so they devise a cunning plan to try and stop these reinforcements arriving. Now, while Dan Kelly and Joe Byrne have left to deal with Sherritt in Woolshed Creek, Ned and Steve Hart travel to Glenrowan. Now, their horrifying intention is to run the train off the tracks, kill any survivors, and then go on to Benalla, which would now be left entirely defenceless, and it would have been easy pickings for the gang to strip the place clean. Ned and Hart kidnap two railway workers and force them at gunpoint to damage the tracks over a steep ravine. Afterwards, they go into town and take locals hostage, holding them inside the Glenrowan Inn and wait for the train to arrive. Now, the Kelly gang have over 60 hostages at the inn, and they pass the time with music and dancing and games and drinking, and everyone's having a lovely, lovely time.
I mean, it sounds like an amazing time
everyone
to be
has
in a hostage.
A good old party.
Good that old is party a good of... hostage experience.
So, as I say, everyone is having a lovely time, so much so that Ned becomes convinced that he is surrounded by sympathisers, and he starts to let his guard down slightly. And he allows a number of hostages to return home. One of these is the local schoolmaster, Thomas Curnow. Now, it turns out that Curnow is no supporter at all, but he has been playing along to discover the gang's plan, and he has overheard them discussing this derailment of the train. Rather than return home, Thomas Curnow runs along the track until he finds the spot that has been damaged, and he is able to signal the approaching train in time for the driver to stop the train derailing. The entire police force is alive and well and really pissed off at this, and they head to the Glenrowan Inn in force and start shooting. The Kelly gang quickly realise that their plan has gone horribly wrong, but they have no intention of surrendering. No. They have one more surprise in store.
Oh, okay.
Now, over the previous few months, the gang have constructed homemade armour for themselves out of metal scrounged from farm equipment that they had stolen out of fields. They had hammered out breastplates and helmets crafted from about sort of 6 mil thick iron armour that weighs over 100 pounds. As the police advanced on the hotel, Dan, Joe Byrne and Steve Hart emerged, armour clad from the hotel, firing at the police.
Oh, beautiful.
Many of the hostages are able to sneak out the back in the chaos and they flee, though two men are caught in the crossfire and unfortunately die. Joe Byrne is the first gang member to go down. A bullet hits him in the thigh and severs an artery, causing him to bleed out. Then came the most spectacular moment of the shootout, as Ned Kelly, who had disappeared out the back of the hotel, emerges from the trees, clad in armour, guns blazing, trying to outflank the police.
Wow.
Now, this sight makes the police think they are fighting the devil himself. They have never seen anything like it. And the armour is terrifying. If you can see pictures of it, they have it in the Victoria State Library. If you saw that coming at you, you'd go, fucking hell, you'd be really freaked out. Mm. And it takes them a while to understand what they are facing. Bullets are bouncing off Ned's armour. What the fuck's going on?
We have taught you nothing, people, is that if you're ever in a tight spot, just go with the element of surprise. Put on every single sequin and every pot and pan that you have in the house and just go out big.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, because we've still got Dan and Steve providing cover from the hotel. They're still firing from there.
Yeah.
Ned's coming up the flank in his armour. His gun's blazing all over the place. And for a moment, it looks like the police are actually about to run. They are completely overwhelmed by what the hell is going on, until they realise that Ned's legs are completely unprotective. His armour covers his head and his torso, and even some of his arms, but his legs are completely undefended. Two shotgun blasts later and Ned is down and he is captured alive. Now, all the while, Dan and Steve are still blasting away from the hotel. By this time, all the hostages have been evacuated and the police decide to withdraw just beyond firing range, leaving Dan and Steve in the hotel. The authorities decide that they are not going to endanger any more lives trying to capture these men. If they want to go out in a blaze of glory, then so be it. The police commander telegraphs Melbourne and requests artillery support. They are going to blow this hotel to smithereens. They send up the cannons. However, this takes a bit too long. Yeah. So they decide to burn it to the ground.
Jesus.
With the men still inside. The Kelly gang is no more. Now, only...
It's very upsetting, Nick.
It's very upsetting. It's just, well, it's as are many of the stories we tell. Only Ned Kelly himself survives the Glenrowan siege.
Wow.
And despite a huge surge in public support for this hero of the common man, he is still tried for his crimes, found guilty, and sentenced to death. On the 11th of November 1880, Ned Kelly is hanged at Melbourne Jail. His last words, such is life.
Oh, that's a good... That's those are good last words.
Those are good last words.
I mean, they're not great last words.
Well, they're sort of like... Well,
they're good. They're not great.
I took my chances.
I mean, we've had better last words on this show.
I don't know.
I am Jack the Ripper. Maybe it's some...
Nah, no. Such is life. I like
my wife might have bloody well turned up.
So there we go. There's a story of Ned Kelly.
Yay! Thank you, Nick. Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful account of Ned Kelly.
Good
story. We'd love you guys to weigh in. Some of our wonderful Australian listeners, please tell us, do you think we did it justice? Or do you know other stories behind it? Or are there little bits and pieces we've missed? What do you know about Ned Kelly? And... does this challenge what you've thought about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what is the current opinion in Australia about Ned Kelly?
What do people actually think about his position, whether he's a folk hero or a murderer? We've talked about this on the show a lot. We have a lot of people, maybe we're doing something for what could be perceived at the time,
for sure,
for the greater good.
Yeah.
They are still murderers.
But they certainly
we do not bleed. Justify and we do not condone, but still.
There's points when you really root for them.
Yeah.
You go, yeah, no, come on.
Yeah.
You've been treated awfully by people.
It's an interesting one. Yeah. We have people from different cultures who are folklore heroes. We've covered them in America. We're covering them in Australia. We actually haven't covered them in England, I don't think.
We haven't. I mean, Dracula was a folklore, is a folklore hero.
Well,
in
Europe, yeah, yeah. So, in England, we have just done the bastards.
We have, that's true. Perhaps we need to do like a Robin Hood sort of character in England.
Yes, Robin Hood would be good. Who should we be covering? What do you think of our interpretation of Ned Kelly's story? What side do you land on? Do you think he's a folklore hero, or do you just think he's a down dirty criminal? What about that horse who was abandoned
and was fraudulently obtained?
Didn't ask for that. Maybe the horse turned up at the last showdown and fired the final bullets.
He was there at the hanging.
Dabbing its eyes with a lace handkerchief.
Just watching.
Just poking itself in the eye with a hoof going, I don't know how to use a handkerchief. I'm not sure. Tell us what you think, people. Jump on the comments of this episode on any of the social media channels that you follow. Tell us what you think. But most importantly, you must mix up a white horse.
Oh, you really should. It's damn good.
Oh, it's so good.
Two in a row that I've been... damn tasty.
You would not think it worked.
No.
It also justifies why you should get some Benedictine.
This is true. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it would be get Benedictine, not chartreuse, every single time. And send us suggestions of more cocktails that we could be sharing on the Poisoner's Cabinet podcast. As we said at the start of the show, if you haven't already, answer some of our questions for the season 2 finale. We want to hear your feedback about your season 1 and season 2 highlights. Also, get your friends to join Patreon because it's a wonderful, sexy, lovely place to be. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the Poisoner's Cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Oh.